So our next session is on conduct risk. We have two speakers from industry. Before I do introduce them, I just wanted to mention we do have a few guests here from the private health insurance industry. So as many of you will be aware, APRA had a consultation last year on bringing that industry under CPS 220, and that's looking likely that that in some form will occur. So we look forward to hearing from anyone from the health insurers either present or on the webinar. We want to hear from what you're doing. Most of the rest of us here are banks, general insurers, life insurers, superannuation. And also, if you can take something away from it and we can learn a bit from your situation. So it's now my pleasure to introduce the next session on conduct risk. This has been a global issue, and this is one of these topics that I think is going to be a common thread running throughout the day. We heard it in Ian's presentation, both conduct and risk culture. We'll hear it mentioned in this session and the following session where we've got a couple of regulators coming in specifically focusing on risk culture. And it's had a significant impact on financial services. Conduct risk interacts with risk culture, remuneration structures, risk management more generally, and community and stakeholder expectations. So we have two speakers who will provide their perspectives from industry, both with local views and also overseas views. Same format as before, questions and discussion at the end. We've got 15-minute presentations from each of the speakers. I'd also add that this session is not open to media, so if any media are here, you are welcome to stay, but you cannot attribute any of the comments or discussion to anyone in this session, so please make note of that. So our first speaker is Darren Williams. Darren's been with ANZ for 8 years and is currently the head of risk for ANZ Wealth's financial advice businesses. He's a lawyer with a background in litigation and regulation. Prior to joining ANZ, he worked with the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, or ASIC, for 14 years. His last position there was Director of Financial Services Compliance, and before that, Darren ran ASIC's financial services enforcement teams for Victoria, Western Australia, Tasmania, and South Australia. With that, please join me in welcoming Darren to lectern.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and thanks for inviting me to speak here today. As I was reviewing my presentation on the plane on the way up this morning, I flew up from Melbourne. I looked at it and I noticed that it's got absolutely no numbers in it. And here I am presenting to the Actuaries Institute. So if you can't follow me, I'm sorry, I can't help you. We'll just kick off the presentation. Conduct risk, it sounds like I don't really have to introduce it too much. It sounds like you've been hearing about it a little bit this morning. I've put down a simple definition of it, and in the business that I work in, it mainly plays out in terms of a detrimental impact on customers. It doesn't, there's other definitions of this, but that'll do as a working definition for this talk. Historically, unlike credit risk, liquidity risk, market risk, it's been something that's been underinvested in, not as well understood, because as I no doubt you've heard in prior presentations, it relates back to culture. Culture's hard to monitor, hard to measure, etc. And so it's been underinvested in, but obviously that is significantly changing now. It is argued that conduct risk is the number one risk to the reputation of an organisation. Particularly if you include in that AML and CTF related breaches, which worldwide have attracted, astonishing fines and penalties, although that does impact my definition there because I don't refer to something that would take that in. But I think the overwhelming view is that those sorts of activities are part of conduct risk. There's obviously a significant regulatory risk that comes with all this. And in my industry in particular, we've been at the forefront of some regulatory activity, and I'll take you through that in a little bit of detail later in the presentation. And then, of course, we've seen in recent times how conduct risk issues can play out into impacting the long-term value, the market value of a business. So, look, it's very important. I think we'd all agree here, otherwise we wouldn't be here. And I just want to take you very briefly through what the regulator is doing. And by regulator, for me, I'm talking about ASIC. So whilst I work in a bank, the main regulator that affects my day-to-day is ASIC and what it's doing. And ASIC, like, you know, internationally and locally, is paying a lot of attention to conduct and culture at the moment, and it's incorporated it very much into its role. And I'll talk to you a little bit about, you know, some of the outworkings that I've seen about how a regulator's incorporating the conduct and culture piece into what it does. And what ASIC is doing, and you've probably, you know, those who interact with ASIC much have probably heard this, their focus is on gatekeepers. And gatekeepers in the financial advice industry, or the financial services industry, include holders of financial services licenses, such as, you know, the bank that I work for. And if their theory is that the gatekeepers have got a ticket to play and they've got a job to do, and ASIC is trying to make those gatekeepers accountable to do its job, so that ASIC can step back and focus on addressing misconduct. That's the theory behind how ASIC is working. And in terms of just some of the activities that have been going on recently in the financial advice industry, they have been less recently, I guess, less overtly focused on conduct and culture, but still that's been apparent. And so those of you familiar with the financial services industry would know that they've been focusing on financial advice being given in large firms, including banks. And they've done a significant surveillance on how the big five, so that's the banks plus AMP, manage advice compliance. And there's been a significant cultural and conduct piece to that surveillance. They've put out a report on it, because part of ASIC's philosophy is to go out there and find out about culture, make some observations about culture, and come back and tell the industry about their observations and what the industry needs to do to lift. And in its report 515, it did it about the financial advice industry and those big five. It's also done a fee for no service surveillance, which, for those not in the industry, it's about taking an annual fee from clients in return for something that you say you'll deliver during the course of a year. And ASIC's view, and it found, was that within the industry, within those big five, there were systemic issues where fees were taken and services not delivered. And it's put a report out on that as well. There we go. So it says up there, what is ASIC planning to do? But it's actually, what is it actually doing to incorporate culture into the work that it does? One of the requirements of a financial services licensee, it's not uncommon around industries, is it's got an obligation, a legal requirement, to report significant breaches of the law to the regulator within a specified time period. ASIC is out there doing a surveillance now because it thinks that holders of financial services licenses aren't reporting enough and aren't reporting it quickly enough. And it's going out to organisations, including my own, and conducting a surveillance of this activity. It's a very large, very large surveillance in which literally hundreds of questions are being asked of all the participants in it. But the really interesting thing about this surveillance is a suite of questions and requirements to produce documents that go specifically to culture and conduct. And so it's asking for, you know, so what are your policies about breach reporting? How are they cascaded to staff? How do you check that staff know about them? And you know, what are the consequences for reporting a breach or an incident, or indeed for not reporting? They're asking questions about who in management is responsible for making decisions around reportability, etc. Now, this has got a long way to go, and it's, you know, it's been publicised by ASIC, so I'm not talking out of school, but it clearly evidences a real very sharp focus by ASIC on culture and conduct. So I guess you can see from that the stakes are pretty high, and what What is it that you can do about this stuff? So the first thing, you know, from my role, and there's no numbers, so we're talking about the vibe here. So what do I look for in my job as a warning sign? And I think the starting point is to understand that in the big organisations that lots of us work for, there are written down statements of behaviour, expectations around behaviours and values, and they, you know, they all look broadly similar, and they're quite easy to write down, but they're very hard to disseminate and have acted upon in an organisation. And so what I look for is misalignment, and I look for cases where the, you know, the piece of paper says X, but the actions suggest something entirely different. And, you know, and really it's not the words on the paper, and you've heard about culture. It's not what's written down. It's what is done with it. It's the behaviours of senior management that actually drive culture. And you know, it's the what gets rewarded gets repeated. So if you say you're going to uphold a particular value and behaviour and someone doesn't uphold it, but they're a big revenue writer or something like that, and you do not deliver a consequence, people notice that and they'll follow that person. So this is not my own. I'm not sure where this comes from. But it really, and it's called there the conduct risk iceberg, but what that really is, and you could use it interchangeably with different words, but that reflects culture. You know, the above the line is the stuff that's written down that all businesses typically have, and then but under that line, that's where the culture is. It's about the unwritten rules. It's about the norms and behaviours, and it's all that stuff, as we all know. It's that stuff that's hard to measure, hard to monitor, and really hard to change. To drive, you know, if you haven't got a good risk-focused culture, to drive that culture, to drive proper conduct risk management. So, who can affect, whose responsibility is it for conduct risk, and what can they do about it? Now, it's obvious, and everyone says it, the CEO has got the ultimate responsibility for it. However, and that's a critical responsibility, and I think without that, without the CEO driving it, it's very hard to drive a uniform, appropriate culture in a business. But the senior leaders have got to buy into it as well, of course. But also, in my view, it's the middle management that you need to capture and that need to also drive that culture deeper into the organisation. And if you don't, you have in a financial services industry where there's advisors, where there's sales and the like, you can have people on the, you know, in the customer facing roles where they can really do you damage, not actually understanding the organisation's expectations around conduct and culture. So middle management is absolutely essential to get on board and to drive the message. And the other thing that I would suggest is the three lines of defence model. It's not used everywhere, but it's common in the financial services and banking industry, is also a very effective tool in assisting the driving and managing of conduct risk. The independence that those roles bring to the table, the challenge that they are expected to provide, can also assist the driving of that. Now, in terms of the areas to target, I think the fundamental one is making sure that your targets, your revenue expectations and how you're going to get them, align with your risk appetite and your strategy around conduct risk. If those two things are mismatched, then something's got to give. And so you've got to really, you can't have a conversation about how wonderful your risk management is in one room and walk into the next room and then have a conversation about how much revenue you're going to get at all costs. You've got to bring those conversations together. Those two things have got to talk to each other. You've got to focus on governance and supervisors. I mentioned middle management before. middle management have to be held to account to supervise. They have to supervise and drive that good conduct into the people that they look after, and they've got to be held accountable for it. The governance piece, that's all about giving people the proper formal channels to escalate, to elevate an issue where it gets noticed and decided by senior management. And you've got to that's got to be watertight, your governance framework. Performance and remuneration, that goes without saying. That has got to line up absolutely behind the expectations of culture, the expectations around managing conduct risk. I think there was discussion earlier about the way that the world is changing around remuneration. Well, people are moving from a sales-driven remuneration structure into something that's more of a balanced scorecard. And then from there, they're moving into a framework where it's in fact behaviour, conduct and behaviours that drive, you know, a significant part of a performance outcome for a person, even a person that's expected to sell things to clients. So that's a very welcome development and absolutely necessary as part of the journey into better conduct and better management of conduct risk. Disciplinary frameworks, and that goes back to the fact that, you know, if it's written down on a piece of paper, you've actually got to measure it, monitor it, and if it's not done, then you've got to do something about it, and people notice that. Checking for time, just about running out of time, which I'm just about running out of slides, so that's good. So how do you do it? Well, look, I've said a lot of things that are really key and critical, but I think that client centricity, and what business doesn't talk about being client centric, they all do, but I think if you really grab hold of that and really understand what client-centric means, and it means preferring the interests of the client in the long term, so they stay with you in the long term. If you can seize on that idea as a business and drive that out to your staff and align their interests with the long-term interests of your clients, so remove that conflict, which has a tendency to manifest itself into poor conduct, I think you go a long way to managing conduct risk if you can secure that alignment. It's not always possible, but it's something that you should really aim for. Communication, I think I've talked about before, it's got to be clear and consistent. It's got to be repeated. Your expectations around conduct and behaviour have got to be absolutely front of mind with people at all times. And then when you don't see it exhibited, then there's got to be challenge of that. Everyone in your organisation needs to be empowered and, in fact, required to call out examples non-conformance with the business expectations around culture and conduct. And people who call it out have got to be rewarded for that. And people who it's called out on, if they don't lift their game, need to suffer consequences. And that's got to be consistent, repeated, and visible. And then the other thing about it, and I'll wrap up now, is just about avoiding complacency. Just because something hasn't happened doesn't mean it won't. You know, the world changes very quickly. The financial services industry changes very quickly. You've got to be measuring intensely, you know, the indicators, and I think Edward will speak about them in the next presentation. You've got to be measuring, monitoring, and adapting to how things change to make sure you stay on top of the culture and the conduct of your staff. With that, I might wrap up and hand it over to Edward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Darren. Two things. Firstly, there's no problem that there was a lack of numbers in your presentation. That's perfectly acceptable. Secondly, it's good to hear a lawyer talking about the vibe. It reminds me of Dennis Donato. So the youngsters in the audience who maybe haven't seen The Castle, well worth a look. All right, quickly on to our next speaker. So Edward Emmanuel is a partner in the financial services practice in Oliver Wyman's Sydney office, where he works with Asia Pacific clients on finance and risk related topics. He joined Oliver Wyman in 2015 and has over 15 years experience in financial services globally, including time at Westpac in its risk management and institutional businesses. He was also head for the Europe, Middle East and Africa region for the market risk specialist Barry Inhibit, based in London. Prior to that, Edward had numerous roles with Moody's Analytics in the UK and the US. He's a Bachelor of Economics jointly from the University of California at Berkeley in the US, the Haas Business School, and the University of Otago in New Zealand. And he also has a Bachelor of Science with Honours in Chemistry from the University of Otago. He's only got 15 minutes, so he can keep the All Blacks Wallabies jokes to a minimum. And with that, I'll introduce Edward. Thank you.
I think the joke's on the Wallabies, isn't it? Yeah, thanks. I don't think that buyer really is that justified giving talking to a whole bunch of actuaries. So you would have noticed the Barry Inhibit experience. So they're a pretty strong sort of consultancy in the UK. Around economic scenario generation. So I had the joy of working with arguably the proudest bunch of people I've ever worked with who are all actuaries. And it was really then that I sort of got indoctrinated and understood what really an actuary was. And I was very, very impressed by the way that they all just held their, you know, I'm an actuary, and they just talked about that all the time. So I'm not an actuary. That's the first admission. But I do know what it takes to be an actuary. So well done. So let's talk about conduct, but without whenever we're talking about conduct, we need to talk about culture. And we've already talked, I think, the last couple of sessions, we've heard a lot about culture. And that's around organisational culture as well as the risk culture. But at the same time, a lot of these terms are incredibly vague. And that's one of the big challenges I think the industry has around a lot of these terms. It's not that conduct is new. It's been, you know, mis-selling or understanding the client's requirements or doing the right thing. It's been around ever since, you know, there was that relationship between selling something and buying something. So it's not new, but this massive increase in focus has obviously got a reason behind it, given a lot of the events that we've seen globally in the last few years. One quick thing, Oliver Wyman is quite a global firm. We're not massive here in Australia, but we do a lot of work with Australian financial services organisations, mainly the banks and the insurers. So a lot of the perspectives and the material I've got here is a bit of a global sort of update on where things are going and what that might mean for Australia. So I've got some numbers, but I think this is the extent of it, and they're not necessarily numbers. They're just our numbers, but they're from survey results more than anything else. It's not a good place. It's not good at the moment in financial services. It's there's a lot of perception that it has lost its way. And when you see some of these results here, and I don't know to the extent you can see all the text, this recent survey where we're saying 30% of those respondents across the UK and US have observed wrongdoing in the workplace. But more worryingly, 20% admit that they would commit a crime, such as insider trading, if they could get away with it. You know, 25%, you know, believe that unethical or illegal conduct is what is needed for success in an organisation. So these numbers are pretty scary. And this was just last year, and it's not an Oliver Wyman; it's a source from a research paper. But it's pretty distressing to see this. So you can clearly see why regulators all around the world are particularly concerned about this, and you can particularly see why financial institutions are obviously struggling and running very hard in order to try and understand what's going on in the coalface. And as I think Darren alluded to, and the experience of that he has of being at ANZ, where, you know, large organisations, complex organisations, many, many people, to be sitting in the group, you know, be the CEO, the board, or the executive team, and hand on heart say, yeah, I really trust what everyone is doing right out in the coalface, and if I'm, you know, lending and agri, you know, those conversations and understanding everything that goes on at the end is nigh on impossible. But we'll talk a little bit about some metrics and these sorts of things that are starting to evolve so you can get a better sense of what's going on, but it's a very, very hard task for the industry. In the interest of time, I'll skip through some of these. I've probably got more material than we need. But this gives you a sense of, I'm a bit lazy. I haven't updated this for everything in Australia, so I'll admit I'm being a bit lazy here. But on this, you see ASIC conduct capabilities assessment. ASIC pioneered, I believe they pioneered, an annual sort of conduct survey and dashboard, which no other sort of enforcement regulator is doing around the world. That's changing now, so they sort of set the tone for a lot of that, even though a lot of the conduct, the most recent conduct-related issues really came out of the UK. So the FCA went fast off the massive PPI issues and other sorts of issues that came through there, the LIBOR, the FX. So we have BBSW, we've had FX issues here, and now clearly we're seeing a lot of other issues coming out in the press domestically. Some great papers and some great thought from APRA and ASIC, I think, in how to respond. Very clear in their expectations through CPS 220, very clear in some of the other notes that they've put out. And Wayne Byers, I think, is doing even more from an APRA perspective to be quite clear on what the bear regime might mean, still working through it, and I think being pretty transparent to the market around all of that. But at the end of the day, massively increasing supervisory demands for the financial services broadly industry to evidence that they have got things under control is very, very hard. So a lot more dialogue and interaction between regulators and the industry, because frankly the regulators need to be educated on these things as well. From that regulatory perspective, we sort of three broad buckets of responses, all related in Australia as well. Conduct regulations, stricter conduct regulations, much more requirements, as maybe many of you know and live and breathe, a lot more requirements on really understanding the customer, really understanding the product that's being distributed, making sure the terms and conditions are completely and utterly transparent and very easy to find, and so forth. High penalties. Now, we don't see that in Australia. And I can't remember the number. I saw a number the other day, but the sheer number of misconduct penalties globally is just astronomical. And it did a great thing for the US economy when they needed it. Was effectively a massive multi-trillion-dollar tax. So we don't see that in Australia yet. There are other ways, obviously, that ASIC are working through this around enforceable undertakings and just more in-depth discussions with each of the firms. But we'll see what happens, I think. And maybe some of you know more than me about what could happen there. The regulatory surveillance, I think, is very interesting. We see globally, but also within ASIC, much more focus and demand on data across the system, bringing the data together, using advanced analytics in order to understand some of the changes that they see, you know, in interactions they can see. So even in the mortgage market, they're using analytics in order to understand, you know, the affordability of housing in different postcodes and these sorts of things. So it's a start of a journey, but they're starting to use a lot more around using data or using analytics to try and, independent from the industry, navigate their way through the system to get a sense of what's going on. So leading banks are responding, and I say the banks here, but really this is financial services more broadly as well. Starting off with basically, you know, having a conduct risk framework, thinking about the key elements of what conduct risk is. And so that started back in the UK with the PPI issues. You know, it's like, gosh, you know, we didn't know all of the selling was effectively going on with PPI. I need to understand conduct much better. Here's a framework in order to sort of set that up and understand what's going on. The three lines of defense model getting a lot stronger in the second line and understanding conduct and engaging very closely with the first line. So that's kind of the beginning phase. Developing phase is very much around embedding those frameworks, illustrating through examples on the behavior that the organization expects and optimizing those. So frameworks in place, people are talking about conduct, not necessarily all really effective through the organization, but definitely in place. There's a lot more conversations at the board, a lot more conversations at the executive team around the sort of the conduct, the mood of conduct through the organization, and then culture, and we'll get to culture shortly around, you know, what is the overarching risk culture in the organization. And then those who are developed, and so a lot of organizations today, it is, you know, the way we do business. You know, the big good old taglines around risk is everybody's business, and those sorts of things are through the organization. Now, the issue with that is these are taglines, and this is commentary as opposed to reality. And so there's a little nice quote that I like is, and it was actually not necessarily a quote, but I think it was the front line of a paper of an article about Goldman Sachs just a few years ago, saying, it was Goldman, and I was talking about both Goldman's and Barclays, and saying, you know, this is all about putting customers at the center of everything we do. That was their tagline. That was very much their strategy. But they were like, no, you go to the canteen to work out what the real risk culture is of an organization and what they're really driving towards. Because if you go to many of these organizations, it's absolutely around revenue growth and drive and market share. Now, that's changing clearly, but go to the canteen, you get a really good sense of what the risk culture is of a particular organization. I too have an iceberg, but it's not as pretty as Darren's one. But this brings out the same point that Darren was alluding to. You know, controls and having controls in place, having a clear articulation of taxonomy around controls and around you know, the right behaviour, is just the tip of the iceberg. Under this is a significant amount of doing the right thing, culture assessments, you know, surveys, deep dives as far as what's going on through the organisation. So it's a continuous, constant, deep, you know, mindset and cultural change sort of investigation that's required. And in this, we see a lot of getting into, you know, culture and conduct related issues. We see a lot of people from HR getting very involved in these programs because they have got the skill sets to understand their way, they navigate their way through the organisation, but also that behavioural element and the softer side of why the people's motivations and the like. Yes, it ties to remuneration and the like, but the softer elements of what's really driving people and the culture change through that, we see a lot of partnerships between risk and HR through these programs. So conduct is an outcome, right? So we talk about conduct risk, but actually it's an outcome. And the behaviour by which people's behaviour is an outcome of an organisation's culture and the risk culture within that organisation. So I think this, you know, high-level framework, you know, provides a nice, you know, visualisation of what we really mean by conduct. We often find that there's a lot of confusion between conduct and culture, although, you know, they're really quite separate things. But at the end of the day, conduct is an output. Driven by the overarching culture within the organisation. To assess culture and conduct, there's no silver bullet on a metric, and that relates to the iceberg to a certain extent. There's no single metric, there's no single group of metrics that can tell you whether you've got a good risk culture or that conduct risk is increasing or decreasing. But increased reporting, increased commentary, increased connection between the first and the second line or the business and the distribution people and those sort of thinking about what that means from a client's perspective. Increase client surveys and feedback surveys. Increase recording of conversations and video conversations between customers and the financial services. Reporting all of that and reporting that out to the group is increasing significantly. Code of ethics, company values constantly talked about. Obviously helps, and that's where you see a big change for organisations at the moment around just constantly talking about the code of ethics, the value of the companies, and then issue identification. So I'll be quick, but we're seeing big changes in just dashboards, use of dashboards, lots of metrics, lots of lagging and lots of leading metrics, but it's taking the organisations years to actually get that together to sort of think about, I just don't have the data to be able to report in a succinct way. But that only gets you some of the way, but at least provides an objective way to sort of start having these sorts of conversations. And we're seeing a lot more of that happening within the industry. So 9 tasks to respond. It's more than Darren's 5, but I think there's a lot of cross. I think we're at the end of the day saying the same thing. Strategy and risk appetite, tools and processes, governance and culture and infrastructure. I won't go through each of these in turn. But it is an overarching culture, organisational culture, risk culture, and then the conduct sort of connections, bringing that together around the 9 different tasks. So operating model, having a clear process, clear understanding through the value chain of a particular product that you're distributing around the areas of conduct risk that could occur through that value chain. Risk appetite, I think there was a bit of a conversation earlier on risk appetite. Very hard to tangibly say what is our risk appetite for conduct. But at least it's sort of being discussed and you're sort of thinking about what is appropriate, what is it a zero tolerance policy? And if it is a zero tolerance policy, what does that actually mean? Policy, standards, guidelines and procedures have to be very easily accessible. You know, the training of new staff that come on board, and they need to understand exactly what is the organization's risk appetite around conduct and related things. I won't go through each of these in turn. Clearly the governance and the culture elements are the key to this, but I would say the infrastructure, you know, related to even the regulators investing significantly in the infrastructure and the data and the analytics in order to try and have some form of early warning system around the behaviour of various individuals, behaviour of various portfolio or products You can use information to at least have an early warning and alert signal for you to then do a more sort of qualitative deep dive. Last but not least, in Australia, the focus has been on cultural and sales process levers. And we've got a few, I'm a consultant, so we love Harvey balls. But I've only been a consultant for 2.5 years, so I'm still kind of getting used to them as well. But big emphasis, we think, on the, there has been a big emphasis on the advice and sales process control. So very control focused. And if you think about a bit of a spectrum between, you know, everything's controlled, huge amount of control process in place, I can't do anything without going through a whole number of controls, versus a very cultural response to this. I don't think you want to be in one extreme or the other. You need controls, but you need a strong culture through the organisation as well. But you can't just solely rely on good culture because that changes. New people come in, new senior management come in. So thinking about the spectrum somewhere in the middle or maybe tilted one way or the other depending on the level of control or the organisational structure is important. With you know, culture and incentives is a big emphasis as well, and less emphasis on business model changes. No real changes we see yet around changing the overall business model outside the FOFA from a wealth management perspective. So that's it, I think. Q&A.
Right, thank you both Darren and Edward. So the gents are here to take questions. Same format as before, please wait for a microphone, make sure it's on, introduce yourself for the people on the webinar and people in the room. We've got about 15 minutes for some questions. So anyone like to start us off? Okay, I'll while you're thinking of some questions, I will ask a question to both Edward and Darren. Will this issue go away? And I suppose where I'm coming from, and as this was all picked up with Ian's presentation earlier, there's pressure to perform. You know, financial services businesses, it's a competitive environment, there's a pressure to be profitable, to generate returns in a low interest environment. You know, low interest environments for banks squeeze their interest margins. And that's obviously the counterpoint to, you know, that puts pressure on conduct. Can we fix it at a macro level?
It's not going to go away because there's that tension is going to stay within the within business models. No matter how much you put the client first, there's always going to be a need for an organisation to make money and people on the ground will either misinterpret or might be led into misinterpretation of what that means in what they do on a day-to-day basis. So I see long-term employment prospects.
Yeah. Employment prospects for who? I agree with that, but I think, unfortunately, organisations and people have a short memory. And so while it's a big focus right now, and while we've got many, many examples in the media and actual, you know, within some of the organisations I'm sure you work for, you know, that will subside because it'll be a bit of a wave. The question, the real challenge will be, you know, a few years after that, will people still be focusing on it? So things like risk-based sort of remuneration, having sort of stage gates around remuneration, I think are going to help, whereby it's got to have good hygiene, good feedback from clients, and passing various hurdles in order to ensure that continues. But it should continue to be a focus. But I fear that we'll forget, the industry will forget in a few years' time and just go back to the topic at the time, which may not be conduct.
Yep. I suppose the other point is we need strong institutions. You know, they need to be financially strong. And you know, if they're making sound and sustainable profits, then that reinforces that position.
Absolutely.
Question over here, Phil.
Sure. Thanks. Andy White from QB. So you mentioned that risk culture is very hard to measure. What are some of the techniques you've seen or would think would be appropriate for trying to measure risk culture? And if you were on a board, what would you be asking your senior management to do to try and give you an indicator of what the culture looks like?
Yeah, so listen, I think it's a work in progress. I think it's deep surveys, it's constant, you know, surveys and deep dives into various areas of the organisation to actually understand what, and you know, sort of open sort of workshops to understand the amount of risk taking that they're taking, you know, so what is the amount of risk that they're taking, and sort of under, you know, seeing to what extent they really understand the amount of risk that they're taking on. It's making conscious risk decisions. You know, where are the whistleblowers? You know, what are, when people sort of see something, how are they escalating those issues? And so reporting the amount of escalations of various things that are going through the organisation is a way of, is good culture. Now, you know, and there are other examples of those sorts of things, and you sort of got quite a long list of those sorts of things that are coming through. The issue that boards, I think, are really struggling, and even executive teams that are, particularly the non-business facing ones, are really struggling with, well, what do I do with this information, and is it good or is it bad, and is it really going to make a difference to what we do? And that is an educational element that's going through many of the boards at the moment. And we see they wanted to see commentary around from the first line around what are they seeing in the market, how are they responding to that in the market, which allows them to sort of start get a lot more colour as far as what's really happening in the coalface. Because at the end of the day, you've got so many different rankings and hierarchies to go through. How do you get a clear vision of what's happening in the coalface up to the board?
Jacob?
So Jacob Mamoufle from Affinity, so I have a vested interest in keeping this going as well. But apart from that, the whole point about conduct risk is unless you have a burning platform, you're never going to get the attention of the board and the management. You know, I've sat, like most of us in this room, either worked on, developed, or reviewed risk management frameworks and documents, and you see risk committee papers, and there's, you know, 200 pages. And so how do you actually get the attention of the committees and the management to actually focus on it? So my question, and maybe it's more of a comment, is as risk managers, is it our duty to try and forever create that burning platform to get attention? Or, you know, and, you know, events like what we've had with CBA and others actually help focus attention. But otherwise, you know, to do a survey, yes, we've all been down that track and we know what the response might be. And, you know, does it actually help us, or is it our responsibility as risk managers to try and keep creating issues so that management will actually pay attention to it?
You've got to make sure that you're not the risk manager that cries wolf, don't you? I think that without necessarily creating a burning platform, I think that an important function that risk managers play is to bring perspective and bring insights from overseas and other industries to help, you know, forward think where the risks are going to be in the future, and then tell stories around that. I mean, that's very trite, but I think you've got to do that. But, you know, you've got to do it in a measured and balanced way to make sure that you get cut through with your boards or whatever. I'm sure you know that.
Yeah, listen, I'm sympathetic to that as well. But you do see differences across boards around the level of attention on risk. And I think the role of the CRO and the CEO and the CFO and those, that triangle working together and sort of thinking objectively around what's going through the organisation is crucial. If those three are not aware and conscious of the risks that are being taken through the organisation, you've got trouble. Yes. And so I think, for me, you don't need to have a burning platform. And if you're just waiting for a burning platform to have a healthy conversation about the risks at the board level, then that's a problem with well, the executive team and the board. And so, yes, we can all look at, and hindsight's a wonderful thing, and look at CBA and look at the construct of the board there. But at the time, we're like, oh, it's great, a lot of technology and it's innovation and these sorts of things. But, you know, Rob, we do a lot of work with David Murray, and one of his concerns in the past few years has been, we go and visit banks, we talk to them about things that are going on. Where's the banker? Technologists everywhere, analytics guys, you know, in the lab, but where's the banker? Who's taking the risk? And that, I think, has been a problem, because those guys who have seen Australia, we've had 25 years of growth, but there's still been bubbles and there have been defaults. So the old school bankers, where are they who are really thinking about those sorts of risks?
Okay. Any other questions? We haven't any questions from the webinar yet. Anyone there? No? All right, I'll ask another one of mine. I like the slide that you had, Edward, about the overseas experience, and obviously a lot of the conduct issues the last few years have come out of Europe and particularly the UK. Should we expect a wave of further conduct issues, or how material is that risk? Is it the early part of the wave, or are we past the crest?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think it's going to be interesting to see how. I mean, Bear is one thing, and I think the senior manager regime in the UK is what the APRA is looking at that pretty closely, as far as how Bear and the accountability related to that. I mean, I get a bit concerned about how Bear and the first line of defence really work. Can you really have the sort of concept of a first line of defence and Bear sort of working alongside each other? Well, I think an APRA, I think, are admitting they sort of need to try and work all that through. But that said, as I sort of mentioned earlier, I think the regulators here have been watching very closely on what's happened offshore, and providing a lot of commentary to the industry, both publicly and behind closed doors, which I think has allowed the industries to be able to adjust and respond and upskill themselves. So I don't know if you're necessarily going to have massive sort of standard changes or anything like that, but I think you'll probably have just continual sort of conversations.
And I think, for my part, I think that the regulators, as I said, I face into ASIC most particularly. I think they've been quite innovative in how they've, taken insights from overseas, and without really any significant legislative change, they've driven an entirely new agenda around this. So I too don't see any significant legislative change around this. I see just a more vigorous pursuit of these issues.
Yep. I suppose we do have a good framework. I remember some commentators in the UK were very dismissive of Twin Peaks 20 odd years ago, when after the Wallace inquiry we went down that route, and it's sort of funny that that's the route they've gone down the last few years.
Yeah.
Okay. Any more questions? Sorry, people are going to get sick of my voice. So please, someone else. There we are. Thank you.
Hi there, Colin Weir. I was thinking about the statistics that Edward put up, and there were some quite shocking numbers in there. I think the one that stuck in my mind was 20% of people would be happy to commit a crime. And I was just wondering, really, kind of what that means for society. I'd like to hope we have a kind of a good selection of people attracted into our industry who are perhaps more honest and ready to hold it. But if 20% are doing it, what does that say about the society, and how can we expect to have good conduct in our organisations if society as a large has, massive numbers of people who are prepared to do these sorts of things?
Yeah, it'd be good to do that survey in Australia. Listen, it's clearly they're really scary numbers, and clearly it's a survey, so there's all sorts of issues around surveys. But I do think it is important to notice that even though there's been years of awareness, in the UK and the US around these things, there are still issues in the industry. I think the massive Wells Fargo cross-sell issue, which came out of the blue. I mean, Wells Fargo had a clean sheet of paper, throughout the crisis, more or less. Was a huge shock. Now, whether that was around, then consciously doing fraud, that's what investigations are effectively going through now to work out, or whether it was more around just the overall remuneration and accountability protocols. Again, be careful with those numbers. Clearly, I mean, it's not representative of Australia, and I'm not certainly suggesting that's the case, but I think it does, make us as a society, aware that. And this is why the regulators are responding as they are, because they are concerned, and the politicians are responding the way they are, more importantly.
Yeah. Any other questions? We've got time for maybe one more. No? John. Okay.
Uh, Hi, John Evans from CBA. Just a very specific question about the, Darren, you mentioned about focus on gatekeepers. I didn't quite understand the point you were making there, that ASIC was focusing on gatekeepers. So can you just expand on that point?
Sure. Now, I'm just trying to think of the recommendation that ASIC focus on gatekeepers came out of a parliamentary inquiry, I think, in about 2014. And the essential point of that is that there are a whole bunch of people in the industry upon whom consumers directly or indirectly rely. You know, we've got ratings agencies, we've got financial services licensees, liquidators, a whole bunch of licensed people who are expected to perform roles either by statute or professionally. And the view that the parliamentary committee formed and ASIC adopted, and I'm not sure, I think that they'd probably adopted it before then anyway, was that if they can get all those parties to do their job effectively, then you have an efficient, effective, compliant market operating, for want of a better word, and then ASIC can get about focusing just on the bad eggs and take them out of the industry. That's essentially what the point about gatekeepers is. That makes sense?
Okay, I think we're out of time, so please join me in thanking both Darren and Edward for some great session.